All right. I wanted to say a few things relevant to the paper, just to sort of clarify what I was hoping people were doing. The first one is that my ideas for papers are only fallbacks if you don't think of ideas for papers. I know one student in my other class sounded as though she thought that I was giving a list of papers and you were supposed to pick one, and it's the other way around. I'm giving a few ideas just in case you don't think of any clever ideas of your own, but I'd rather you do, because that expands the amount of stuff I know. In terms of what are suitable topics for papers, in terms of a paper on a legal system, the requirement is really that it be a legal system very different from our own. I'm willing to be fairly flexible on what counts as a legal system. For example, I've had papers on things like the legal system of a criminal gang in the California prison. Very different from our own, could be contemporary if it's somebody like the Amish, for example. Right? The Amish legal system really has very little to do with the modern American legal system other than coexisting with it. On the other hand, I would expect that pretty much all national legal systems, there might be exceptions, really are part of the same family of them. That if you think of, I mean, obviously British and American law, but even if you think about French and German law, which are not Anglo-American common law, but they're still coming out of the same general set of 19th, 20th, maybe 18th century traditions, so pretty similar. So if you pick a legal system, it ought to be one which doesn't look as though it's a cousin of ours, if that makes sense. If you pick a thread, which I'm not sure if anybody's doing, but it's certainly a very real possibility, it ought to be an issue that runs through some of the very different legal systems, possibly the ones we've studied. You don't have to have research new ones, though you can. It can also exist in our legal system. That is, it's not that you can't talk about modern legal systems, but you shouldn't be talking only about modern legal systems. Any questions on that? All right, I hope to be getting ideas shortly from those of you who haven't sent them in already for what interesting papers you're going to do. Any questions on Tuesday's class?
Is there something strange about Tuesday's class?
No. Oh, okay. I start every class with any questions on the previous class. My assumption is that it may have occurred to you between Tuesday and Thursday that something that sounded perfectly reasonable then was obviously nonsense, or you couldn't understand it, or it was wrong, and therefore a legitimate topic of conversation is what you've thought about between the previous class and this class. Similarly, I start pretty much every class with any questions about the readings. Is there anything that you read about the Gypsy Law in what I thought was maybe the most interesting chapter, which was the one you read for this time? Are there things there that you thought were wrong or didn't understand or wanted to discuss or whatever? All right, I don't believe I should do all the work in this class. It gets boring if I do. You're supposed to talk too. Yeah?
Well, there was something in the reading that I kind of wasn't really sure of.
Yeah.
I kind of kept referring to this Marxist ideology about gypsies, and I wasn't really sure what they were referring to.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it struck me as a little bit odd, but I don't think it was really an ideology about gypsies. I think it was somebody who I know nothing about other than what's in that chapter, who had ideas about the evolution from civil law to criminal law and the way in which societies evolved. And that is a very interesting question, though I haven't read him, that I think there is, in a sense, a legal system which has existed in many parts of the world and which may perhaps be the first legal system everywhere, and that's feud. And details vary. But the basic logic of it is a decentralized system where what enforces rights is the willingness of individuals to use force in defense of their rights. And in a functional feud system where it's structured in such a way that doesn't result in loss of continual violence. So I like to argue that the first essential requirement of a working feud system is that right makes might. That you have a system where when you wrong me, I threaten to use force against you. There's got to be some reason why that threat is more believable when you have wronged me than when you haven't. Otherwise, it's just a straight extortion game. All right, and how it's done varies across the different systems that we see. So that if you think about one we haven't gotten to yet, the Icelandic system, there's an explicit court system, there's a law, And what the reason right makes might is that I don't use force against you normally until after a court has given me a verdict. But I can then, there's no one else to enforce the verdict. I can enforce the verdict myself. Your friends won't support you, and my friends will support me. And if your friends do support you, they are themselves breaking the law, and therefore anybody who gets hurt in that conflict can sue them. And I don't know if I've quoted you my favorite little bit on this from Njalssaga, where somebody, a sort of benevolent neutral, asked how he'll help one side in a conflict, where it looks as though they're going to start fighting in the middle of open-air courtroom, says, well, if you're losing, I'll draw up my men armed over there. If you're losing, you can retreat behind them, and that'll end the fight. If you're winning, I'll come in and break up the fight before you've killed more men than you could afford. So the assumption is that even when things are breaking down, eventually, if you kill someone, you're going to have to pay for it. It's quite a sizable payment for killing somebody, and that restricts the amount of violence. Terry's question? No.
I do, but I'll wait till you're done.
All right. Yes.
Is there any correlation between the size, between the effectiveness of any type of legal system or government and the size
of the population? Yeah. That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer.
Okay, because I assume it variables depend on, the kind and then the size, and it's going to, it'll all...
You can imagine it depending on a lot of things, and I don't think that I know, but I agree that it is an interesting question, that people sometimes, for example, I sometimes offer the Icelandic system as evidence that you could have a functioning non-governmental enforcement system in a modern society. Mm-hmm. And one of the responses I get is, but that was a population of 50,000 people. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't work in a large population. I don't know if that argument is right or not. Mm-hmm. The counter argument to that is to say, well, look, if you're thinking about ordinary economic arrangements, if you try to imagine a market economy in the sort of first couple of chapters of a textbook model, it's individuals trading with each other. And you could easily enough say, well, that's fine for a small population, but once you get to millions of people, how could I ever find the person selling what I want to buy? And the answer is, because by the time you get to millions of people, you have all sorts of intermediaries, you've got corporations, you've got advertising, you've got a bunch of mechanisms, so that in fact, arguably, the market system works better with a large population, not smaller, that wouldn't be obvious if you're only looking at a small population ones and seeing how they do it. Mm-hmm. All right? So similarly here, a feud system which depends on everybody in the society knowing who the bad guys are isn't going to work very well in a modern society, but you could imagine a feud system with the equivalent of sort of intermediaries, corporations, reputation, I'm not going to go into details, but you could imagine one as it's scaled up, developing more elaborate institutions that are logically the same structure, if that makes sense. So that makes it hard for me to answer your question, basically.
Yeah, no, I see. And what happens to the people in that population that don't want to participate under that legal system?
Well, that depends. In lots of situations like ours, you don't have a choice.
Right?
If you say, well, this is a very nice legal system and all, but I want to use heroin, and I don't think the government should make it illegal, you may go to jail. Mm-hmm. So now you'll have situations in which different subgroups interact among themselves by different legal systems, mm-hmm. and that can be de facto as with the gypsies, but it can also be de jure as with the Jewish populations in the Middle Ages or the various ethnic groups in the Ottoman Empire, where the overruling society mm-hmm. basically says, all right, you people can interact with each other with your own rules. But then they still have the problem if they have conflicts outside the group, obviously. You can imagine a lot of different things happening, and you could imagine a feud society in which some people formed sort of large groups who said, well, within our group, we'll settle it through a court, but in interacting with other people. And as one of the interesting things about the Somali case is that you have quite a structured feud society. You've got a feud society in which everybody, in effect, knows, well, I'm in this group of so many people, and this group is part of that group of so many more people, and this group of so many more, and I can pretty well predict if we have a conflict who will be on my side. And it's not a governmental system. These groups are structured in part by kinship and in part by just voluntary contract, but nonetheless, it's quite a highly structured system. And now the Icelandic, I think, is much less so. But it's pretty clear if you read the sagas that people knew who their friends were, as it were, and who was, you know, if somebody, if I get into a conflict with someone who is likely to be on my side. But what I was going to say about feud systems is that one requirement for it to work smoothly, to work reasonably well, is that there is some mechanism such that right makes might. And the one you've just read about, the Roman Shah, it's basically a fairly small society. They have pretty well-defined norms of behavior. And so there, what it does it is just do the other people who are around you say, yes, indeed, he cheated. Therefore, when you go to beat him up, we're not going to stop you. Maybe we'll help you. That's the sort of story he's telling about the car purchase case. So that's a mechanism. That mechanism wouldn't work very well in a large society because you wouldn't know enough, obviously. But the Icelandic one would work on a larger scale with an explicit court system. And you could imagine other ones. If you think about how reputation works online, for example, it's not a question of the use of force, but if you think about how eBay is set up, eBay has fairly elaborate mechanisms designed to, in effect, enforce contract by reputation. That you have feedback mechanisms, and you can think of other ways in which a large society could try to do the equivalent of a small society, but in more elaborate and different kinds of mechanisms. Another feature which I think matters for feud systems to work is that there be some way of terminating feuds. That the story you get by people who think that feud is a bad word is you kill one of my relatives, then I kill one of your relatives, then you kill one of my relatives, and so forth and so on. And there may be systems which that happens, I don't know. But the ones that I know very much about, it pretty clearly doesn't. And in the Icelandic case, there are really three different ways in which things get terminated. One of them is the court gives a verdict and the people abide by the verdict. So that, you know, I killed your brother. The court says I owe you 200 ounces of silver. I pay you 200 ounces of silver. It's all over. That's one possibility. Another possibility you get in the sagas is essentially an out-of-court settlement. So that you have a dispute and the parties agree. So-and-so as an arbitrator will abide by his decision. The extreme version of that is self-judgment. So that you're in a very weak position. And so you go to the guy who's got a claim against you and you say, I'll give you self-judgment. You decide what I owe you and I'll pay it. And you're relying, you hope, on his having incentives in terms of reputation to show how generous he is and that he won't take advantage of you. But that's obviously a risky thing to do, and sometimes people aren't generous in those cases. But then the third termination mechanism is leaving. So that in the Icelandic case, if you are outlawed, which is what happens when you don't abide by the court verdict, you have 2 weeks to leave Iceland. Well, if you leave Iceland, you know, it's conceivable that someone on the other side will track you down and kill you. The last chunk of Njalsaga, basically in Njalsaga, Njal and his sons are burned in their house by their enemies. And one foster son escapes. And a chunk at the end of Njalsaga is that foster son hunting down and killing one after another, the people responsible for burning the family in their house. Now, that makes it sound as though it's more one-sided than it is. I mean, people have gotten killed on both sides in this particular feud. And in fact, it's arguable that what's happening in Njalsaga is that Njal is deliberately not telling his son to try to fight their way out because he'd rather have his family die than have the feud continue, so to speak. And his sons are pretty formidable warriors, even though they're outnumbered. But I say one of them does make it out. And there's this great scene somewhere in the Orkney Isles where he shows up in some local lord's feast hall and he goes and kills someone. And, you know, why do you kill someone in a feast hall? Well, he's one of the people who burned my foster father Njal and the family, and I've been hunting him down. Oh, it's a pretty good reason. All right, we don't mind. Quite an odd scene. And at the very end, he makes peace with, I think, the leader of the attackers who was one of the relatively good guys on the other side. And sort of that's the end of it. But normally, just you leave Iceland and the issue is essentially over. And similarly, one of the points made in this chapter is that there are really two, I think, Okay, put it that way. There are really two, in effect, ways in the gypsy feud systems that you terminate. One of them is you leave town, other than settling, which they clearly have. But you can also leave town. And what you see in the description of the Kale, which you may have read, I gave that as an optional chapter, chapter 7, is avoidance. That essentially, there you've got families, and one of the things that happens is that you've got a feud going, we're sort of officially at war with you, so to speak, and we could hunt down one of your people and kill them, but that's sort of dangerous and unpleasant. So instead, we just try to avoid having anything to do with you, and you avoid having anything to do with us, and maybe after a while, it's not clear how long, but maybe after a generation, everybody's forgotten what we're feuding about, and so it disappears. But there don't seem to be formal mechanisms for terminating in that system as there are in the others. And in the case of the Kale, we've really only got one source. That is one anthropologist, I think Finnish, Granfors, I think his name is, who's the person who did research on them, and that's what's being cited here. So one of the points made in the chapter you read is that he observed them for a fairly limited period of time, so we don't know whether 20 years later those feuds would still have been going. He had, by the way, one of the interesting things that shows up, I think you can see in the footnotes of the chapters, is that he had a real problem with the Finnish legal system, because you have one of the Finnish gypsies is accused of a crime. Is he willing to testify, given that his testimony might be yes, as a matter of fact, he probably did do the killing because his cousin was killed by somebody by that guy, you know, a year and a half ago, and they've been at feud ever since. And it's pretty clear that Granfors feels quite uncomfortable, as it were, about betraying his people in some sense, the people he's been interacting with and getting information from, to the legal authorities, especially since it's not clear that he doesn't think, well, perfectly legitimate, in a feud. That's their system. So I think those are a couple of the features that make it work better. And I think you can also, I would argue at least, that feud systems still exist, even if they don't involve axes, and that if you look at things like some modern litigation, why did we sue you? Because you sued us. Why did we sue you? Because we did something that you did something we object to. And there, one way of looking at our legal system is it's a mechanism so that right makes might. That insofar as my weapon for getting you is suing you in a court, that's a more effective weapon if I'm going to win the case than if I'm going to lose it. Might work even if I'm going to lose it, because I can impose costs on you, but it's more effective if I'm going to win it. So as long as the court system is moderately reliable, being in the right makes it easier to use the threat of lawsuits as a way of punishing bad behavior.
But doesn't our legal system kind of encourage them, and more of a might makes right? Because it's like, if you have the resources or the ability to have superior legal counsel, then you have more might.
But in exactly the same sense, in the Icelandic case, if you've got four sons who are good fighters, you're going to have some advantage over someone who doesn't. And the part of the Icelandic solution to that problem, and I don't know to what extent, I guess you've got equivalents here, the Icelandic solution to the problem is that if I've got a good legal case but don't have the resources to pursue it, I transfer the case to somebody else who does, because he's going to collect damages. All right, you've killed my son. I'm, an old man, not very strong. He's the only son I've got. My next door neighbor, on the other hand, has got four tough sons who went a Viking in their youth and lots of friends and relatives. Hey, and look, Snorri over there clearly owes me 200 ounces of silver because he killed my son. He owes me weregeld. I can't collect it. He'll beat me up if I try to go to court. I'll transfer the case to you.
So in Iceland, they could do that. I mean, someone else could bring a case for you.
With your permission. In effect, tort cases were marketable. So, yes. No, this is my basis for claiming that the modern American legal system is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. Because you could at least argue that it would be an asset to our system there are two different cases where we would like to do it. One of them is where the victim doesn't have the resources to hire a lawyer, or doesn't even know enough to know how to hire a lawyer. All right. See, one of the ways that we try to take it in our system is a contingency fee. Right? That's our solution to your problem, one solution. One of the problems with the contingency fee, though, is that it requires the real victim to know who to give the case to. Right? So you say, I'll give you half the damages. But I don't know how hard you're going to try to win the case. On the other hand, if the case is marketable, all I say is which law firm will pay me the highest price for it. Then it's their problem. So, but the other case where at least I've argued that it might be useful is as a substitute for class actions. Because if tort claims were marketable, you could have mechanisms for assembling lots of small tort claims into one person, and that one person could then sue on his own behalf rather than in class action. Yes?
It's actually kind of possible to transfer torts because you can, lawyers can't do this because there's all kinds of ethics rules against it, but, you know, like if I'm a poor person, I can contract with someone who has more resources to pay for my legal counsel, and then afterwards I pay them a big chunk of my damages. I mean, I would still have to appear in court and deal with a lot of the onus, but the financial issue could be taken care of. I mean, although you couldn't have sale of torts and fault, which is what you decided. But
I guess the real answer is that I'm not enough of a lawyer to know what problems you would run into in trying to sign a contract of that sort. Now, you can do it in the context of insurance company, that there are rules in which your insurance company can pay off and then sue on your behalf.
Yeah, that's the idea behind a lot of insurance.
And of course, as I say, you can have a contingency fee. But I'm not aware of mechanisms for actually selling for a fixed price, but I could easily be.
I mean, it would have to be
the question is, if I sign a contract, signing over my recovery to you, is that an enforceable contract?
I don't know. Well, you can actually, these is obtain loans against a judgment. So, you can go to a lender with, a meritorious claim and get a loan against that, and then afterwards you pay back, with the intent that your recovery is larger than the loan.
Yeah. Well, interesting question, which I don't know enough about. Let me go back to a question that I raised last time, was trying to think a little bit more about whether it makes sense to think of gypsies as hunter-gatherers, because hunter-gathering is, in some sense, the original human form of organization, the original human economy. We only started agriculture, 8,000 years or so ago, and our species goes back maybe 200,000 years, something like that, I think is the estimate. So one of the questions I was thinking about, and I don't know enough about it, really, is the idea would be that they're like hunter-gatherers, except that instead of gathering fruit and hunting animals, they in various ways subsist on the humans around them, and how different are they from ordinary structures, and how much like hunter-gatherers are they. So what are the features of hunter-gatherers? One of them is that they are typically small bands, that hunter-gatherers, as I understand it, don't really have countries or nations. They've got bands of 50 people kind of size or 20 people kind of size. And it sounds, looking at the descriptions of the gypsies, as though you don't really have political, you've got a thing called a nazia, a nation, but that nation doesn't have any government. It's an ethnicity rather than a political structure, so that sounds a little bit like it. Hunter-gatherers are usually mobile, in part because, they don't have the reason the rest of us have not to be mobile. Right? If you plant a field, you want to stay around to harvest it. But if you're not planting fields, that's not an issue for you anymore. And to the extent that hunting gathering means, at this time of the year, the fruit are ripe here, and over here, there's something else, there's at least some tendency. So I don't know enough about hunter-gatherers really to have a clear opinion on it, but it did occur to me that one possible paper topic for some very ambitious person who likes the anthropological literature would be the legal system of hunter-gatherers. That I've had papers on specific hunter-gatherer types, but it would be interesting to see if one could figure out if there are common patterns. Again, legal system broadly defined. If you say, how does disputes get settled? What determines who gets what share of an animal that's killed? Sort of all of the rules that are the equivalent of a modern legal system in a society which really has nothing that we would recognize as a government or a legislature or any of that. That might be one interesting potential thing to do. Now, I don't think one can plausibly identify feud systems with hunter-gatherers because First, I don't know of evidence that within hunter-gatherer bands you have feud. One of the arguments you get, by the way, which seems to be partly between archaeologists and anthropologists, is whether hunter-gatherers are or are not peaceful. There is a book called Warfare Before Civilization by an archaeologist who, it's an entertaining book, it's worth reading, and he describes how he was had a research project involving, I think, the first agricultural population in Europe. And they had walled villages. And when he originally applied for funding, he took it for granted that these walled villages were walled to protect them from other human beings. And his application was turned down on the grounds that everybody knew that primitive people didn't engage in warfare. And so he redid the application without that assumption, and he got it funded. And oddly enough, it turned out that there tended to be a lot of arrowheads excavated, you know, in the area around the gates of these walled villages, from which he suspected that his original conjecture was right. And his argument, at least, is that if you look at primitive people, they tend to be very warlike, that they don't seem warlike to us because their populations are so small, so that you have, you know, a confrontation in which four people are killed. Well, that doesn't sound very much until you realize it's four people out of a population of 50, and that's huge. That's more than we normally lose in our wars. And also that a lot of the conflict is not battles but raids, where you know, you sneak up and murder the men and seize the women and the children, essentially. But I gather there are also modern anthropologists say, no, that's just you know, us looking down on them, and they're really very peaceful, so I'm not an expert on this. I thought the book was persuasive, but I would have to read the other side to know, to have an opinion of whether it's right.
I have done minimal anthropological research, and I tend to agree that perhaps they were more warlike than what researchers say, or historians say, give them credit.
Might well be, but I don't know. But in any case, but it's interesting, and just as I'm arguing that one can think of some litigation going on in a modern society as sort of a modern version of feud, it's interesting to think about whether there are patterns in modern society that really look like hunter-gatherer patterns going on. To take one example, I think there's a tendency for hunter-gatherer societies to be gift economies. All right. Gift economy is an economy where the normal way in which you do exchange is not I will sell this to you in exchange for that or for money if there is money, but rather I will give this to you. But we both know that if you are a decent, respectable person, you will then want to do something for me. And in the Elder Edda, which is very early Norse poetry, I think about 9th century, there is a verse of good advice attributed to Odin. And one of the verses has the line, no man is so wealthy that he objects to receiving a gift in exchange for his gift. So they know what they're doing, essentially. But there are modern gift economies. All right. Let me take the very simplest example, which has struck me a long time ago, which is suppose that I invite a colleague and his wife over for dinner. And we enjoy our company, we have a good dinner, and so forth. And then I do it again. And it turns out that for some reason, there's no practical way of their inviting us over for dinner. They're in a small apartment or something. If you didn't know anything about human society and just thought about the world as an economist, and they feel that they are, as it were, in debt to us, that we've done something for them, and then what would the obvious solution be?
Send you a thank you card or...
Well, a thank you card isn't very much. What...
Bring a bottle of wine.
No, you know too much. Just imagine you're an economist and not a human being. The obvious solution is to give me some money. All right? But they'll never do that. All right? That's what's interesting. That in that sense, in addition to being in a monetary economy for most of my life, that's a gift economy I'm in. That they will think it is appropriate to give me a bottle of wine. They might think it appropriate to invite us out to dinner at a restaurant where they're actually paying money to the restaurant. But the one thing that they won't do is a straight cash payment to me. All right. So in that sense, we've got sort of built into our ordinary monetary exchange economy certain elements of the gift economy. And it's true in other contexts. I mean, I won't go into details, but I can think of various parts of my life where I'm parts of sort of social networks, which are really run as gift economies where people do things for other people, and there's some assumption that people do things for them, but there is no explicit quid pro quo, let alone a not only cash, because they wouldn't see. It isn't just the question of money. It also, I think, wouldn't occur to them. It wouldn't occur to me to say to them, look, I'll invite you over for dinner if you'll take me out to a restaurant next week. All right? That would be a barter exchange. No money involved. It still feels wrong. Right? It feels as though the right thing to do is to do it, and then because they're the kind of people you like, they will feel the right obligations to do it back. So that's an interesting case where gift economies are, I think, fairly common in more primitive societies, but they exist in our society as well. We just don't usually think of it in those terms. So let me think of a different issue, which is really, in a way, coming up if you look especially at the embedded systems, and that's the difference between two different ways of controlling a social structure, which are voice and exit. There's actually a book with a title along those lines. So one way in which you can get your society to do the right things is to make arguments, you vote, you have various ways of pressuring the society. And that, theoretically, is how our governmental system works. But another way is, if you don't like it, you leave. That I like to say that the best form of government I know of is competitive dictatorship, and that's the way restaurants are run. All right, I've got several favorite restaurants. I have no vote in what any of them serves. My guess is that I end up with a better meal than if I were part of some collective group of 100 people running a restaurant and we had meetings every week and had votes on what to put on the menu. So, voice is one mechanism for controlling things. Exit is another one. Now, exit is only going to work if exit isn't too costly. That's one reason why exit is to some extent a constraint on modern governments, but it's not a very strong constraint on most of them because most people really don't want to move to a different country. Maybe more of a constraint where you've got countries adjacent to each other that are very similar. But on the other hand, exit really works in two quite different ways. One of them is it gets you out of what you don't like. So you can say, even if my action has no effect on the world, there's a restaurant here, there's a restaurant here, there's a restaurant here, I can pick the one I like, and if that one goes bad in some way or another, I can leave. But the other thing is that the existence of exit gives restaurants an incentive to try to offer the menu that people want, because otherwise they won't have any customers. And you can imagine, similarly, if I think about the gypsies, the gypsies' exit isn't so. Exit from gypsy community isn't very easy, but I'm not sure to what extent my family can exit from one group of families interacting by. Oops, there's an incoming call, which I shouldn't have. How about I reject the call? Sorry about that. Just noticed something buzzing. So exit also puts pressure. If you think about a group of gypsies, if you've got a collection of gypsy families which are working together, presumably one constraint on how they function is some of the families might go to other collections. And I think pretty clearly, if we look at the Amish, we haven't gotten to yet, the fact that individuals can say, well, I'm going to leave this congregation for that congregation is going to be a significant constraint, or I'm going to start my own congregation, which they're free to do. So it's worth at least thinking about those as different ways. How about your experience? To what extent do you feel differently about those associations where exit is not really an option, or at least is a very costly option, and those where you can pretty freely drop in and out? Does that, if you think about your own experiences, is that a different kind of world with different? Well, I'll let you think about it. But yeah,
Competitive dictatorship is based on exit, right?
Competitive dictatorship is the case where what constrains the dictator is the fact that they have nobody to dictate to unless he gives them what they want. So if you think about hotels and restaurants, those would be my classic examples. Okay. They're dictatorships in that the customers have no vote at all on how they're run, but an absolute vote on whether or not they're customers.
Okay, so it's kind of like the free market economy that's operating underneath the democracy right now.
Right.
But it isn't
always a market economy. You can think of a political case as well. Suppose you've got a bunch of small countries where people all speak the same language.
Right.
even without democracy, even if some of them are dictatorships, there's going to be considerable pressure on those countries to behave in a way that makes taxpayers want to live in them.
Yeah. No, I was just trying to see how these things are playing out in our modern.
Yes. Well, think about states. If you think about U.S. states, U.S. states are more constrained by exit than the U.S. than the federal government is, because it's a much more minor change to move from here to Oregon than it is to move from here to Canada, let alone from here to England, say. And in fact, an interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, is to what extent politics are different in countries which have their own language as opposed to countries that share their language with others. So I wonder, for example, I guess there's the one big example would be South America, because there are two important languages in South America. One of them is Spanish, which almost all the countries speak. And one of them is Portuguese, which the one biggest country, Brazil, speaks. And I wonder if you sort of, to what extent Brazilian history is different from the history of the Spanish South American countries, because exit was more of an option if it's just, if you don't change your language. And, but similarly, I mean, you can think of lots of other examples, but that there are countries where Hungary, well, there are Hungarians outside of Hungary, so I guess it's not quite true, but, or Finland, I think Estonia, I think, speaks a related language. But basically, you've got cases where there's a country where almost everybody who speaks a certain language is in that country, and they presumably have more of a monopoly power over their own members than a country where there are six different languages, different countries all pretty similar. So if you don't like England, you can move to Australia or New Zealand or the U.S. or whatever. Yep.
Can I ask you a question? Find that when you can be.
For the competitive dictatorship, how did that not cross over then to tyranny? Like, where are the lines?
To tyranny. Well, I guess one question is whether or not they can stop you leaving.
Okay, so there would have to be a mechanism that would prevent them from stopping you from leaving.
If they, that's right, or at least makes it costly for them to stop you from leaving. Yeah, no, I would think so. And
so you kind of drew a dichotomy between exit and
voice.
And voice, okay.
Voice being all the ways by which you as a member of that group try to influence the group. So voice includes democratic voting. But voice could also include going to the king and saying, look, Your Majesty, wouldn't it be a better and nobler thing if you did X instead of Y? All right, so I'm just using a very, very sharp distinction between ways of getting institutions to do the right thing by staying in and acting on that institution versus ways which depend on the fact that if they don't do the right thing, you leave. And those, it seems to me, are important distinctions that run through a lot of political and other institutions. And it matters. That is, if somebody's, suppose someone says, look, this company is really terrible. They've got a dress code. They've got this. They've got that. It's just as bad as a dictatorial country. Well, you'd like to know, are the people in that company locked into the company? If it's a situation where that company is the only company in its field, its employees are experts in that activity and really have no jobs outside of it, then it really does sound like as though it's looking like it. If it's a situation where there are 17 other companies which producing the, hire the same kind of labor, any worker who doesn't like the dress code can go to one of the other ones, then it really isn't oppressive in the same sense. And then one suspicion is the people who are there are probably ones who don't mind being required to wear coat and tie. When I was an undergraduate, you were required to wear coat and tie in the dining hall. This may seem like a weird and bizarre idea in the ancient history of America, but it was in this country, in a prominent university. And the result was that I always carried a rolled-up tie in my pocket and wore a sports jacket, and when I went into the dining hall, I put the tie on. But the going back to some more stuff on the gypsies for a minute, one can argue that part of their tactic is staying illiterate in the dominant language as a way of maintaining separation. That is, gypsies normally do speak the local language as well as their own language. The Amish speak the local language in their own language, but the Amish are also literate in the local language as well as their own language. So it's not the same pattern. But you can see that illiteracy somewhat reduces the influence on their members of the host culture. It somewhat reduces the options that their members have outside of their own culture. So in that sense, it may make sense, although, again, you can say yes, but as we move to a technology with television and movies, you can be influenced by the host culture even if you can't read because you can understand the spoken language. And so that may be less true now than it once was. One of the things which I've only seen sort of traces of in this book is the question of what's changing in gypsy culture. That there clearly, from various things in it, are sort of modernist movements within the gypsy community. And I can't tell, do these represent 1% who are somewhat acculturated, or do they really represent serious changes in what's happening? But you could think of the widespread existence of non-written culture as being important, of better transport as affecting more mobility, more options, and so forth. Gypsy law is regarded as oral. Is our law oral? Any of it? In any meaningful sense?
Judicial opinions are often orally explained.
And more generally, statute law, you have a written specific statement of it. But if you think about the rest of our law, it may be in writing, but it's not in writing it's not in the form of a definitive statement. It's in writing in the sense that you've got casebooks, the stuff you read, and what does the casebook do? It is somebody's verbal description of what he thinks the law is, in effect. So there's a sense in which you've got a sort of a continuous variation. Yes?
So certain oral traditions are verbatim.
Yes. I was, in fact, going to give as the, in a sense, or what I'm saying now is that our written law is in some ways like an oral law, but it's true the other way as well. The Icelandic situation, someone is still trying.